Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special episode of Imperfect Leaders. When the world's most innovative organizations need a little inspiration, they turn to IDEO. IDEO is the most iconic design studio in the world. Clients are far-ranging and global. Think juggernauts like Coca-Cola, Ford, IKEA, and yes, they actually helped Apple create the very first mouse. If that weren't enough, one of IDEO's founders helped design the modern fold-down laptop computers that the entire world uses today. And for nearly 20 years, Tim Brown, today's guest, was the CEO and orchestra conductor at IDEO, leading an incredibly diverse and creative team to unimaginable heights. So I hope you'll enjoy today's conversation, soaking in Tim's wisdom on everything from creativity to leadership to career transitions to artificial intelligence and to the very future of innovation. What is the difference between creativity and innovation?
Well, to some degree, creativity is the how and innovation is the what. You know, I mean, creativity, innovation is something new and useful that's in the world that wasn't there before. Non-obvious, perhaps, something that isn't just a simple incremental development of what we already have, but a new something new. And whether it's a new technology, whether it's a new scientific method, whether it's a new product, a new service, a new experience, a new brand, mm-hmm. all of these can come under the umbrella of innovation. Mm-hmm. Some of them require great deep technological and scientific skill and knowledge. Others require just connecting things together that have been not being connected together before. And that's where creativity comes in, right? I mean, you know, whether it's a scientist asking a creative question about, what if I looked at the world this way and leading them down a path that gets to an innovative new hypothesis or theory about or truth about science, you can think of that as being creativity. Or, you know, in our case, it's, well, what if we gather lots of insights about the world, understand people, and from that, imagine how the future might be. Imagine how a new future product or service might exist. Then that's the kind of creative leap that gets you to whatever that new thing is, and that new thing is the innovation.
Give me some examples. You know, what are some cool examples of, you know, big, hairy, audacious problems that IDEO has helped clients solve?
Well, you know, over the years, it's evolved. And I mean, back at the beginning, the early days, we were mostly getting to work on early, if not new, technologies, whether that was, you know, helping figure out how to take a very rough, impossible to make prototype from Xerox PARC of something called a mouse and turning that into using innovation to figure out how to make that inexpensively and at scale for the originally the Lisa computer and then the Mac. Mm-hmm. Or figuring out what the design of the first laptop should be like. Mm-hmm. The idea of folding a screen down over a keyboard, which seems really obvious now, but was actually quite a new idea back then. So starting
you guys
off,
help do that?
Yeah. And one of our founders, Bill Moggridge, who's unfortunately no longer with us, literally his name is on the patent for folding a screen down over over a keyboard to make it, and designed the first ever laptop for Grid Systems called the Grid Compass, which is in the Museum of Modern Art, and it's just a beautiful object. Starting from things like that, it's evolved to broaden out from products to services and digital experiences and the whole system, such that these days, or you know, more recent years, we've done things like have the chance to work with a wonderful organization in Latin America, in Peru, to design a whole new education system for the country that's a low-cost private education system that's been incredibly successful. Now I think is more than 75 schools, spreading out to other parts of Latin America, where we got to design the campus, the curriculum, the business model for the schools, the whole classroom experience, the teacher training system, literally a whole new system from the ground up, which doesn't come along very often, but when it does, it's tremendously exciting. It's funny. I'm incredibly nervous before I go on stage, but I never get nervous before I start a project. I don't know why, because the stakes are way higher. But I think that's one of the, you know, one of those mindset things that's to do with design thinking, which is a certain level of optimism that one has that one's going to get to an answer, and whether it's the best possible answer Don't know. Whether it's an answer that's ultimately going to get to where you hope it'll get to, don't know. But there's a sort of a level of optimism that I think we have as creative people. And that, and in fact, my colleague and one of the other founders of IDEO, David Kelly, talks about this idea of creative confidence. That and the creative confidence being about this combination of the self-confidence to have new ideas and the determination to actually kind of make them happen. Mm-hmm. Because it's the combination of those two things. It's not just having an idea, it's building it in some way. There's a level of sort of an overlap with entrepreneurialism in a sense. It's not so much about building a company, although it can be. Mm-hmm. It's more about building an idea. How do I make an idea real?
From your experience, is the second part harder? I mean, realize the potential of a good creative idea than just coming up with a creative idea?
Well, you know, there are three major steps, if you like, in the creative process, if you want to step back and kind of really abstract it. In many ways, the first and third are very difficult. They're all hard. But if the middle one is having ideas, right? And we put a lot of energy into how we have better ideas. And we've got all kinds of ways of doing that. But before you can have an idea, you've got to actually ask a good question. You've actually got to decide what it is you're wondering about, what it is you're trying to solve. And we spend not enough time generally, certainly in business, in identifying what the right question is. What's the best question? What's the question that can, and you know, and when that question is great, when that question is formed really well, it makes all the difference to the quality of the answer you get to. So I think that bit's pretty hard. It's generally something we don't spend enough attention on. We might kind of leap to, we've got to solve this problem, or the question is an obvious one, and it's obvious. One of the first things we often do when we're working with organizations uh-huh. is listen to what they're trying to achieve and then come back with a different question. We think you're actually trying to solve this thing, not that thing.
Why do people jump too quickly to like trying to solve a problem that they think is the right question?
You know, I think often because we're rushed, we don't give it time. We're literally not creative enough about our curiosity. I mean, if you think about it, so many of the great fundamental breakthroughs in science, for instance, have come by somebody asking a totally non-obvious question. Mm-hmm. You know, when Einstein asked, what would it be like to ride on a beam of light? And what would the universe be like if I did that? Uh-huh. That was a non-obvious question. But boy, did it get him towards a whole bunch of important ideas like the theory of relativity, right? Non-obvious questions. And sometimes they can be really simple non-obvious questions, which is instead of just like, letting the world go past, it's just stopping and asking the questions, why do people do that? Mm-hmm. Why do they do that? And when you ask that question, it's like, well, they don't have to do that. They could do it differently. And then that opens up a whole new avenue of exploration. So often I think it's lack of time. We don't give ourselves space. It's why playfulness is an important part of innovation and creativity. Just sort of tinkering around with ideas, tinkering around with things, tinkering around with questions without necessarily always having a kind of a clear purpose. You can't spend all of your time doing that. It is an important component of creativity.
You know, it's funny. I have a 2-year-old son and he, all he does is ask questions and, you know, is curious. Can I learn how to be a better leader and a better innovator by watching him?
Absolutely. Because some of that outright curiosity, because you know your son's got a big brain to fill, right? It's got all that capacity to take in new experiences, and he's voraciously sort of hoovering them up as fast as he can. And and as we get older, we've stacked our brains full of experiences, and we tend to often, when we see a pattern we've seen before, we don't get very curious about it. We just respond to, well, we know what that is, and we move on. Whereas kids, they haven't seen these patterns before, and so they wonder what everything is. And so putting yourself in a situation where you're exposed to wonder what the things are that are around you, to look for those new patterns, is an important part of being creative. It's why often travel is a good inspiration for creativity, right? Go to a new place where everybody's doing everything differently. The culture's different. Maybe the visual landscape is different. The smell's different. The colors of things are different. And it gets you thinking differently. And that's because, again, as I say, as human beings, we have a tendency to shortcut and assume we know what's going on, and that stops us being curious.
So when a client then, has that initial meeting with you and you go back with your colleagues at IDEO, and then you come back to the client with a different question.
Well, I'd say two things about this. One is we do our best to do it with the client rather than going away and coming back to them, because nobody likes to go on a creative journey where they only get to stop off on little bits of it. I mean, and I think that's actually one of the great lessons over the last, several decades of, if we're going to be effective with creativity and innovation in business, we have to bring people along. People have to experience it. Sometimes it's the business itself and the leaders of the business, but often it's their customers as well, right? I mean, we have to think differently about how creativity happens. So that's one thing. Secondly, sometimes it's about just about on our, our experience of like, there are some sort of simple ways of thinking. If you think the problem is one thing, this was one of the great architects, Saarinen, who did the St. Louis Arch. He used to talk to his students about this very simple idea. He said, if you're trying to design a chair, you need to think about the room. If you're trying to design a room, you need to think about the house. If you're trying to design a house, you need to think about the street. In other words, nearly always when we think about a problem, it helps to step one kind of frame back and think about it in a wider context. So that's one of the things we often do with a client. It's like, okay, what's the wider context for this problem? You think you need to design this product, but how does this product fit in a wider context? And why are you thinking about the product? So those kinds of questions. Or sometimes it's because we go and spend a bit of time looking and visiting with and understanding their customers, and maybe come back a bit and say, you thought you were satisfying these needs. Well, it turns out from what we can see, your customers are actually wanting this set of needs to be satisfied. So maybe we should rethink what the question is that we're trying to ask.
And do you look for a certain set of qualities when you take on a new client, like that intellectual curiosity? Or, certainly I would think that if they're rigid, it's going to be a tough journey for you guys to go on together.
It is, and there's a lot of trust involved in any kind of creative process, because unlike so much else of what we're used to in business, where you sort of know the answer before you ask the question, you sort of, if you're trying to implement some sort of efficiency-based process, then you sort of already got proof that it works before you go ahead and do it. But in creativity, you don't have that, right? You don't know what the answers, you don't know the answer that you're going to come up with. Therefore, you've got no proof in advance that it's going to work at all. It takes a leap of faith. And so, I mean, many of our most, I think, impactful client relationships have been ones where we've built trust over time, and maybe we do something quite small at the beginning, and then people realize it works, right? And then their curiosity goes up, and their imagination starts to flower a little bit. We sometimes we look for people we think of as enlightened leaders, at the very least, who care a lot about the people they're trying to serve, right? At the very least, they're trying to serve their customers, their stakeholders, with some sense of purpose, because that tends to make them more curious.
Because I would think some of these leaders, in business and government and education, have gotten to where they are because they have, they're used to making quick decisions and exuding confidence and not necessarily, working and showing their vulnerability and their softer side. And right away, just trusting, someone that they haven't worked with before. So, although it sounds, easy and a very, apropos word to use, trust, but I bet it's difficult sometimes to get that.
It is. And we're coming off a period of many decades of relative stability in the way we thought about business, right? And certainly the last few decades have been very much about building more and more and more efficiency into business, fine-tuning our business, particularly when we think about how we manufacture things, how we distribute things, how we market things. We've just got better and better and better at doing some of these same things. But we're facing a period, I believe, and we're in the middle of it already, where so many of those assumptions no longer hold true, where we're being disrupted, whether it's because of pandemics and the way changes in the way we work. Assuming we know how to do things, assuming we have the answer is a very dangerous position to hold. And so for me, I think it means that as leaders, and particularly as CEOs, we have to shift our stance. And I've had many CEOs say this to me over the last, several years, which is like, it's not about me having the answers anymore. It's about me knowing the best questions to ask. But it's not so that I can have the answer. It's so that I can help people ask that better question about where we should be spending our time, about how should we should be spending our resources, about where we need to compete, about where we need to differentiate ourselves, about how far into the future we should be looking. These are all questions that CEOs have to hold today. One class of leader that I find naturally tends to ask questions and think differently is any leader with a founder's mentality. Whether they were actually were a founder of the organization, or whether they've just brought that founder's mentality somehow into the organization, but that founding mentality is one often of, well, firstly, not being confident that the future is going to be like the past. Secondly, having a really being in touch with customers and stakeholders and the internal organization, and often being dissatisfied with what has already been achieved and a desire to achieve more.
If you think about some of the modern day leaders or some of the clients, you know, CEOs of some of the clients you worked with, who comes to mind that is sort of an inspirational creative leader?
Obviously we've all looked and been inspired in one way or another by the Steve Jobs and Elon Musk and people like that in the world, but they're wonderful innovators. But I mean, I think of people that I've worked with. So, you know, for instance, the recently retired CEO of Ford, Jim Hackett, who I've actually worked with for 30 years, because previous to that, he was CEO of Steelcase, the big industrial office furniture company. Mm-hmm. But he is a leader who's absolutely committed to the idea of design thinking, absolutely committed to this idea of being human-centered, but also somebody who was constantly asking questions about the future and challenging me and us when we worked together and his own organization to try to think about the complexities of the future and what that meant for the organization and how one might respond to that. And I think a lot of what you see today in terms of Ford's strategy around electric vehicles, around kind of mobility-based services, came from his tenure and his leadership. So he's an example. Another great example is somebody who you probably haven't come across, but by the name of Carlos Rodriguez Pastor, and somebody who is constantly asking about how can I make, you know, Peru the best place to bring up a family, and what and so he doesn't just stick with, you know, normal businesses, but he's built a school system, he's built a healthcare system, he owns universities. I mean, he's just like got this incredibly broad view of what it means to serve kind of a community.
So I'm still fascinated by this creative leadership notion. And, you know, I think that stories are an integral piece of that. I mean, who pays attention to a PowerPoint presentation? Why is that important that creative leaders become good storytellers?
Because we're often trying to describe a future that doesn't exist yet. And, a story is a way of bringing, literally it can be a spoken story or you think about how good movie makers are at bringing worlds that don't exist to life in front of our eyes. And we quite often do that as designers. We'll create movies of the future to show how a world might be that doesn't exist yet. And that has to be a world about humans. It has to be a world that can't just be about stuff. We're not just like PowerPoint presentations don't really connect to people. Stories about things don't really connect to people unless there are humans involved somehow. I think that's why we're often fascinated by these documentaries about how entrepreneurs achieve things, or how something got invented. We're much more interested in the people than we are in the things themselves. Storytelling is literally the way that we bring everything to life, right? I mean, we're a social species, right? We create influence, we get things done, we create community through stories. Mm-hmm. And we always have done for hundreds of thousands of years. And so it shouldn't be surprising to us that's still the most powerful way of getting people to fall in love with whatever it is you're already in love with.
Yeah, tell me what you mean by that, because suppose, you know, a listener is a hardcore introvert. You know, should that person be totally frustrated, or can that person actually practice and become a better, even a great storyteller?
Well, yeah, it just means that you might choose to deliver the story in a different way. Not all of us can be Barack Obama and get on stage and be this wonderful teller of a story. You know, sometimes it might be about, so for instance, often a lot of what we would go and do is like, if we want to tell a story about something out in the world or about how people experience the world, we go and film the people, right? We go and make videos of users doing stuff and the frustrations they have and the thing, and we show that, right? We don't need to say anything. I don't need to stand up and give the story. The people speak for themselves. you know, another close colleague of mine who I've worked with for years, who is a genius storyteller, but his favorite method of telling a story is to write a children's book. And he'll take a really complicated business idea and reduce it down to a 10-page children's book, and it will connect to anybody and everybody. And so there are many different ways of telling stories, and each of us can find our own preferred method.
Yeah, it's so inspiring because you don't have to be, you know, this charismatic, extroverted person up on a stage telling a great story like Barack Obama. There, you know, you could create a documentary, you could create, write a children's book. You just have to think of what resonates with you and how can you tell that story?
Exactly. Unfortunately, we have so many tools in it today that means we can do things maybe on our own or with a small group that we used to need, you know, a Hollywood team to do for us, right? And when we can make movies with our phones, we can make quite decent images using some of these new AI tools, and that's just going to get easier and easier to do. I mean, I think that the techniques of storytelling are going to become more and more accessible to us, and so that should. I mean, nowadays, I mean, this has been true for years now. When you know, we teach classes at design classes at somewhere like Stanford. Most of the end presentations are made of videos. The kids make a video, right? And they've been doing that for years. And so a lot of younger folks in business now are quite comfortable using these storytelling tools already.
So, and speaking of young people, you know, the ones that I come in contact with really want to make a big, bold, positive impact in the world. And you've written one of the best books that I know of on this topic, you know, Change by Design. At a very high level, how can some of the principles in your book help them accomplish these big dreams they have?
Well, I mean, I think the lesson that I learned, and took me a while to learn it, which is you can have a big dream, but it doesn't necessarily mean you need to solve it or capture it or grab it all in one go, right? That a lot of the big, let's say climate, right? When a lot of young people want to make a difference in climate. None of us is going to be able to solve the climate problem alone, obviously. We're going to have to find places we can make our contributions. And know that we're contributing to this much bigger picture, and that should make us feel great. And so you can take on, if you like, a kind of a wicked problem, but find the piece of it that you can contribute to. The wonderful thing about a moment we're in right now, which is, you know, at some level very unstable, very volatile, but a little bit scary, is that we're beginning to coalesce around some of these really big problems, and many, many of us are working on them, whether it be climate, whether it be, you know, kind of inclusion and, you know, racial justice, whether it be healthcare, exactly, education. These, you know, we know these are big problems. We know these are things we need to do differently in the future, and we can begin to work on them collectively. The other thing, of course, is, you know, with technology helps us be part of these collectives in a way that we couldn't be before. We can be working with people who might be on the other side of the planet. We can know about things that are going on a long way away, and use those to inspire us. So I would really encourage anybody who cares about some big problem to get involved in it, but to experiment and explore and approaching it from different angles, maybe, and not try and kind of solve it all in one go.
And yeah, I think that's really good, because I would think that if they're dreaming too big, you know, the problem's too wicked, it might just become a pipe dream and they may get frustrated.
There's nothing wrong with it. It's just that tends to then what you will get to probably is a contribution that's about ideas that you'll share with others that will then inspire them to go do something. You know, if you're going to create something that in itself, so maybe you want to do a startup. If you're going to do a startup, startups can't be too broad at the beginning, otherwise, you know, they just don't succeed. We know that about startups. So, I mean, in some ways, it's sort of trying to figure out how you like to have an impact in the world. Do you like to have an impact in the world by building something, you know, like a new company or a new technology that's going to make a direct impact, in which case it probably needs to be quite focused? Or do you like to have an impact in the world through others, by inspiring them to do something that they wouldn't otherwise have done, in which case maybe you can develop ideas that are meaningful and helpful. Maybe that's a new approach, a new tool, a new way of thinking about something, a new story. And so you have to reflect a little bit. And I would, I mean, you know, I've tried many of these different approaches and I've enjoyed many of them. And I would encourage young people to think about how can I look at making contributions in different ways as I go through my life? Maybe I do a startup when I'm younger. Maybe I teach when I'm older. Maybe, you know, whatever. I mean, that can be pretty satisfying, I think.
It can be. But like, if I just look at the other side of that same coin, my father would say that's career mismanagement, because you're not staying focused. You're not becoming better at a particular thing. You're not developing a name for yourself. You're not becoming better at it. But you're saying you could switch, and I agree that you could switch jobs or even careers many times and be happy and productive.
Well, I mean, I'll give you my own example. Right? I mean, yes, I've stuck with design my whole career, but in that time, I've gone from working on my own projects to working on team projects when I first joined IDEO, to leading those projects, to then leading the company. So I was building a company. I wasn't working on the projects anymore, to teaching, to developing ideas about where design's going, to writing book, and these days I spend a lot of my time helping and advising other people who are trying to do these things. So I've had so many different, I mean, I look at my 35-year career and what I see is not so much 35 years as a designer. I see 35 years broken up into chunks of contributing in and through and with design in different ways. And it's incredibly, I mean, I find it quite, I've really enjoyed it. It's been wonderful. And you know, each one of them has required me to develop new skills. It's required me to take a different approach. It's required me to change my personality and the way I think about things and grow both as a person and as a designer.
Which one did you enjoy the most? In our, I bet I know the answer, and you like them all for different reasons, but you tell me.
You know, whatever one I've been in the middle of, unless I've been anxious to move to the next one, I've been enjoying that the most, right? I loved running IDEO, loved it. Well, one, I loved working with several hundred of the most creative people I've ever, you know, I could ever define. I used to get constantly blown away by the ideas and quality of ideas. I found it so stimulating. It helped me think about what it, you know, where it was all going, what it all meant. And this is something that, you know, I realized pretty early on, which is like, so much of the joy of whatever you're doing comes from who you're working with rather than what you're working on. And these were just like really wonderful people to work with. So, you know, that's possibly why. But now, you know, I've relinquished that. I'm loving being back in the work again in different ways. And actually, you know, working on working kind of closer, being back closer to design again in a kind of hands-on way. And that's really a lot of fun.
What was the hardest transition for you to make during your career? You know, you say that you used to be part of the project team and you were the group leader and then a CEO and then a thought leader. And
that's a good question. I don't know. I've never really thought about it. I mean, it was hard to let go. Stepping out of the CEO role was hard.
And why did you step out?
Why did I step? Well, I mean, for multiple reasons. Firstly, I realized I'd been doing it a long time. I mean, 20 years in the CEO. And secondly, I knew that the organization needed a new generation of leaders, needed new ideas. It was ready to go through a next cycle, and I didn't think I could figure out. I wasn't sure I was the right person to figure out what that was going to be.
And how did you deal with the transition of stepping away, having done it for 20 years?
Well, you know, the thing that I was most scared of was after having kind of, you know, when you're leading an organization, obviously you've got a fire hose of things coming at you. You actually don't have to be awfully proactive about your time most of the time because there's more than enough things to do. And I was actually worried about, how am I going to decide what to do? Do I still know how to design? Actually, was a question I had in my mind. And so, you know, I took quite a bit of time when I first stepped out of the role just to think. Mm-hmm. And just, I'd just hang out with other with designers. I'd hang out on projects. I would just sort of slowly work my way back into. And you know, I did a few interesting pieces with some clients. And just got, to some degree, got my kind of confidence back. And so that was important to have that time. And maybe in some ways, COVID made that easier because we were all sat at home, not doing some of the things that we were doing before anyway. But I just spent probably about a year just spending all the time I could with other creative people, having interesting conversations and seeing where my ideas went.
If you think about the CEO role in general, especially since you've have sat in that seat for so long, or you did, how is the specific role of the CEO changing? And can one person even do the job? Is it fair that we put that on one person's shoulder? You said earlier, it's like drinking from a fire hose.
The idea that we can focus all of the authority and accountability for everything that a particular large organization does onto one person is a little ridiculous when we think about it. And the requirements of business as they get more complex, with more and more challenges, less and less predictability, just make that harder and harder. And we talked about it a little earlier, but the idea that the CEO is the person at the top of the organization with all the answers just does not seem to be credible to me anymore. Because if you think you've got the answer, you almost certainly don't, because there's something about it hit you from the side you didn't expect, for which you don't have the answer to. And so if you go around as a CEO thinking you have the answers, you're just even more vulnerable to the moment when you don't. If instead you go around thinking, what are the right questions for me to be asking? What are the right questions for me to be asking the organization to ask? And to be constantly on the lookout for new knowledge, constantly on the lookout for new insight, constantly curious about what we're not worrying about yet that we should be, or not imagining yet that we should be. And that, I think, is a great role for a CEO. That one's job then is not so much to decide on behalf of the organization, it's to unlock the potential of the organization. And I think the best CEOs, and this is probably has been always true, the best CEOs are the ones that best unlock the potential of the organization. And sometimes that means redesigning the organization so that potential can be unlocked. Sometimes it's about pointing the organization in a new direction so that the potential can be unlocked, in terms of new strategy or whatever. But I think it's more important to have questions than answers. And it's really important to think about how you're unlocking the potential of the organization you have.
So if you were going to apply the principles of design thinking to the design of an organizational structure, or even what a CEO should do, or how could you help the CEO be more effective?
Well, I'm not sure whether this is a kind of a magic bullet or anything, but part of the problem with the way most companies are structured today, and certainly public companies, is that you've got a lot of senior people who are very talented, but their future is dependent on the CEO deciding about the next step in their career. I mean, their report literally there's a reporting structure which affects the way people can think on can think and the way that they might advise you as a CEO. You might have a board. The board is there to represent the shareholders. Again, that affects the way they can help you think as a CEO. There's nobody really, and as you talk to CEOs all the time, they tell you how it's an incredibly lonely role because they've got nobody who acts like a peer who can force them to think about hard questions, who can offer new ways of thinking. And so, just like you see it in politics, so you see how in the role of the president over the last several decades, you've seen this
Ranger.
emergent of a set of advisors. They're not the secretaries of a department. They are the national security advisor, whatever it might be, political advisors. They're there to help the president think. And I think CEOs deserve that same kind of increased thinking capacity that might come from having some advisors, particularly ones who think very differently from the CEO. So if the CEO is an efficiency-oriented person, then maybe they need people who can help them think more creatively. If it's the other way around, if the CEO is a very creatively oriented person, maybe they need people who can help them think more operationally.
As I'm talking to you, you kind of remind me of yet another guest. Do you know Ed Catmull of Pixar?
I do indeed. I love it.
He told me the stories of how the directors used to, come together and talk to all the other directors
Exactly.
in a brain trust, just like you're describing with
Exactly.
presidents. And it was
Exactly.
a chance to be totally vulnerable and show your product and show us what you got. And it almost always was a tough, vulnerable process, but it always made the product better.
And they were peers of each other, right? They're all directors, right? And they know that they could be in the same position, as the one that you might be trying to help. And maybe that's the solution. Maybe it's about CEOs helping other CEOs. I don't know. But I do think as leaders, we need people to help us think and to help us consider things we might otherwise not have considered.
Can the board play that role if it's the right kind of governance structure?
I think it can. I mean, board members would have to be, you know, at the top of their profession, whatever that is. They would, you know, I mean, for instance, I think if I was to put, you know, and I do have people I use as advisors today, some of them are 30 years younger than me. They're not 70-year-old board members. They're people who are looking at they're thinking about the world totally differently because they're just growing up in it. And that's just as valuable form of advice to have as it is somebody with lots of experience and lots of wisdom. Hmm.
Yeah, I love that. And then just going back to IDEO, you know, for some of the young, creative, passionate students out there that might be even considering a career with you guys, how would you describe, you know, the culture of IDEO?
Like it's a culture of curiosity. It's a culture of optimism, where people are confident that they can do interesting things, confident in their own abilities. Actually, as creative people, it's a wonderful learning environment. I mean, you know, it's a wonderful learning environment partly because it's a creative environment, so you're looking to discover the future all the time. Secondly, because of, you know, our kind of business where we're working for companies and organizations in almost every facet of society, you have the opportunity to sort of make these connections between different worlds. I mean, I've had so many experiences where I might have been in one meeting where we might be talking about, you know, a sort of a soap powder brand into another meeting where we were talking about designing spacesuits of Mars. I literally had that experience one day. But I mean, the joy of connecting different things together, which is where so much creativity comes from in the first place. I like to think that, you know, for folks that come here, it's like a graduate degree in innovation and creativity in itself. And, you know, a lot of folks have gone on to do wonderful things after being here, but it's a chance to work with people who are like-minded and, but yet have very different skills to you. And to create things that did not exist in the world before you started working on them.
Any new exciting lines of business coming out of IDEO? I mean, what's it going to look like in 5 years?
Well, you know, I mean, we, you know, with everybody's talking about how AI is going to potentially kind of somehow destroy creativity or damage creativity. I'm not sure it is. For quite a long time, we believed in the notion of not so much of artificial intelligence, but augmented intelligence, that this technology can help us as human beings be more creative, be more than we are today. And we've been working on those ideas for quite a long time now, I mean, years. And I actually brought a group of artificial intelligence and data science experts, acquired a company that does that many years ago now, and then started to embed those folks into the work that we do here in IDEO. So we've got a lot of people working on that. It's really exciting, and they're exploring the role of these technologies in all kinds of things in fun ways. You know, we've talked about health a couple of times already. We've been working in healthcare for 30 odd years. There are so many exciting and new things to be working on there that we continue to explore, whether it's in pharmaceuticals, whether it's in healthcare delivery, whatever it might be.
So should individual creative people be afraid of AI? What's the difference? AI is going to be able to do this in 5 years anyway. They're going to be able to write as good or better a screenplay than I ever could.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, I was actually reading an article this morning. It was in Wired magazine where somebody, a movie producer, had asked an AI to create a soundtrack for a movie along the lines of Hans Zimmer. And, you know, it basically, yes, it had used the style, but it had done a lousy job of creating a soundtrack that didn't have taste. Uh-huh. And I think this technology will continue to fall short around things that we are very discerning about as human beings. And so it will automate or replace a lot of what I might think of as routine creative tasks, if you can think about it that way. I mean, and that is threatening to the livelihoods of some people for sure. And that is something that we need to be thoughtful about. But it also can provide tools that allow many more of us to take ideas that may only be trapped inside our heads today and give them expression. Turn an idea into a piece of music. Turn an idea into an image or a or an object or a movie or a or a or an essay or a story, whatever it might be. And I think that's a, I think that's a good thing, and that we will ultimately see it raising the bar. I mean, we've been in this place before. I mean, admittedly, this is a more dramatic version of it. But, you know, I can remember back in the late 80s, early 90s, when desktop publishing showed up. Everybody thought that was the graphic, because suddenly we could all do our own font. Firstly, we remember how bad all that stuff was. But actually what it created was a renaissance in graphic design, because talented graphic designers actually had to say, well, I don't have to worry about that stuff anymore. So the tools will handle that. I now can think about what, you know, how to use graphic design in a more expressive way. And there was a huge explosion in new experimentation that actually pushed graphic design forward. My gut tells me that's the same thing's going to happen here, and that we'll see a lot of new experimentation in all creative forms, and maybe even some new ones emerging, which will be good for society and good for creative people.
Ethics. You know, what role does ethics play in design thinking and all of the things that you're talking about?
Clearly, it plays a role. It has to. One of the dangers of this sort of optimistic creativity is that we can enthusiastically explore the future without necessarily thinking about the unintended consequences of what that future might behold. And so, as we see the downsides, it's behoven on us as designers and innovators to think a little bit more about the unintended consequences while we are still developing these ideas, while they are still malleable. And so that's something that we've introduced into our practice, into our work over recent years, is literally to have workshops where we ask all the unintended consequences of the things that we're creating. Another aspect is, particularly as so much of the world that we're designing today is not sort of physical products, but it's more like, but they're experiences that people have, they're services that are delivered digitally that weave their way into people's lives in a very intimate way. It's become more and more important that we're not arrogant in thinking that we can design for people, but we have to design with them. And so more inclusion, bringing more diverse voices into the design of these experiences so that we don't have the biases, for instance, that we're seeing in AI algorithms today, that we avoid those things. Or that we create experiences that are actually meaningful for the people for whom which they're designed. And so we're doing much more of working with communities in a kind of more collaborative way to design solutions, whether that's in cities, whether that's in services and systems, whether it's in this country or whether it's in other parts of the world. So I would say those two things, more kind of inclusive design and design where we're thinking harder about the unintended consequences, are two examples where kind of ethics are really important.
But isn't the inclusivity sort of part? I mean, it sounds great to bring a lot of people with diverse ideas into a room, but doesn't that create a more coarse, abrasive discussion where people are more likely to butt heads? And therefore, doesn't it like take a certain kind of leader like Toby Cosgrove with that empathy to get them to gel as a cohesive team?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are different ways of bringing voices into the process, right? I mean, sometimes it's to ask them all to be the designers. That, as you say, the more diverse that group is, the harder you've got to work to build the kind of language and trust and everything else you need for them to create together. Another way to do it is to take your ideas out when they're still very rough and ready, and work with people to make them better.
Tim, our time is up. We could talk for another 2 hours, but I have thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed this wide-ranging conversation, and I would encourage every single person out there to go buy your book if they haven't already, because it's amazing.
Well, thanks so much, Jeff. It's been a really enjoyable conversation.
Thank you so much to our audience around the world for listening, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you have any questions or comments for our guests or want to attend private conversations and events, feel free to visit us at www.imperfectleaders.com. Until then, we hope you'll join us next week.